Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Taught a bunch of seminars when I was working for CrossFit in Australia, and we spent a bunch of time down there, and the amount of shit talking that the girls were doing was like almost being like, holy shit. And then I realized it was because the guys were such assholes.
That's a really good way to put it, and
the girls are like, God, you guys are so nice. And I'm like, this is like the prickliest version of me. And they're like, yeah, no, this is not nearly as bad as most of the Australian guys. So it was
truly, it was
hysterical. I got a good laugh out of it. We were in Newcastle, and I remember.
Oh, you're kidding!
Yeah. We taught a
That's
bunch
my hometown.
Of hometown. Oh, well, they stopped serving booze at like 6 o'clock, and the bars had to close by like 7 because they had so was many. I don't know if it's still like this, but I remember we went out and they were like, "Yeah, no, we got to get to the bar by 4." And I was like, "Why?" And they're like, "They stopped serving booze pretty early." And I'm like, "Why?" He's like, "Because if they serve booze late, the fights were that were happening resulted in a lot of deaths." So we got to go out and get hammered early. And I was like, all right, you guys might have a drinking problem.
Yeah. Yes, correct. Australia has a drinking problem.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you experienced it firsthand.
Yeah.
It's a very different lifestyle down there.
Yeah.
Ironic too, because everyone's fit. You look at everybody, they're fit, they're outdoors, they're up at 4 a.m., they're training, but they love a drink.
Yeah. Which I'm not opposed to.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean... Yeah, I really liked the culture. And I was like, man, it was one of those only places I've ever been where I mean, it's funny. I've traveled all over and I found like Australia. I liked New Zealand and Japan. I were like the three places that I could have lived easily for the rest of my life. I find America a little bit more difficult in some ways.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, the opportunity in this country is beyond anything that I'll ever experience back home. But there's definitely an element to Australia that I really miss. One, the ocean, but two, I think just the laid back nature of society. Everybody's just,
Well,
here it's a little different.
The fact that I think the population of Australia is slightly bigger just by a little bit than Southern California, where I'm from, like kind of blew me away. And then when you look at this kind of geological map of like where people are, like heat map, it's like everybody's at the coast and like there's nothing in the middle. And it's pretty neat. We went down to Perth and taught seminars, obviously, in Newcastle and all over and like kind of that whole Gold Coast area. And I had a really wonderful time. Enjoyed it a ton.
Incredible. It's very rare that I meet somebody that's actually went to Australia. The common response is, oh my gosh, you're from Australia. Oh, I wish I could go there. It's too far away. But you've got big animals. And I'm like, oh, okay.
They don't give you the classic Dumb and Dumber, like, throw another shrimp on the bobby. And you're like,
I'm just like,
yeah. You're like, I've never heard that before. This is brand new.
Yeah. Wow. Who talked to that?
Yeah. So how did you get here? Like Australia to Austin? I mean, like, what was the journey and the path to get here?
Great question. I had this unexplainable desire to work and live in America. Can't really tell you why. I think the main thing I can attribute that to was loved the movie Stomp the Yard. And my whole life I was like, Americans are so cool. I want to live there. I want to work there. So I was like, I'm going to find a way. So classic Australian comes here a year before and does all the cities of looking for a job in Miami, in LA, in New York, in And funnily enough, there was this company that was really, really eager to get me to just come see them and experience a day with them. And that was in Dallas, Texas. Funnily enough, I take that job. Totally not part of the plan. Never, ever considered myself moving to Texas. And that was the initial catalyst to bring me to Texas and America initially. And then from there, yeah, I've been all over, lived in San Diego, now in Austin, and finding home in Austin, I think.
So what was your background? I think doing a little bit of Google searching that you were a college track athlete. Did I read that right? Were you an athlete?
I did. I would say a mid athlete across many different sports.
Okay.
I grew up running track. I mean, I was probably a 400 runner. Mm-hmm. If I was to describe myself as a sprinter, I'd say 400. Swimming, did squad swimming growing up, triathlons, and then got into soccer quite heavily growing up. Mum and dad was coach, mum was manager, my sister was defense, I was up front. And that was probably a big part of our life growing up until I got heavy into strength and conditioning at a young age and then CrossFit for a short period of time and stepped into that world.
And then how did that journey into the PT world? So you were training, everybody gets hurt, let me go start working with these athletes, and that kind of started you in that road down there?
It was, I'd stepped into strength and conditioning, and that totally changed my life mentally more than physically. And with that, I was very, very passionate about that beyond just doing it because it's good for me. And along that journey, I was actually studying biomedical science. I majored in advanced medical research, stepped into that world, and recognized that most of the people that I worked with had zero people skills. Nobody could look me in the eye. Nobody could hold a conversation. I thought, is this the environment I really want to be around for the rest of my life? So I thought, no, I'm going to do medicine. I want to be a doctor. So I left and I started the process to go into medicine, but that's a year-long process. So in the interim, I thought, well, I'm loving this fitness world that I'm in. How about I step into physiotherapy? It's technically like a pre-med degree back in Australia anyways, and then I'll go into medicine. And throughout that journey, I ended up absolutely loving it. And I spoke to some doctors and they said, look, you can give up the next 15 years of your life and step into medicine. Or if you're really passionate about what you're doing, do it. I'd be envious of the lifestyle that you would have if you were to stay with that career. So I stayed. And yeah, fast forward, graduated as a physiotherapist back in Australia. I worked across all the disciplines, spinal cord injury, neurological, ICU, athletes, just general private practice. Came to America, started working in it, and experienced the traditional healthcare model that I very much didn't agree with and left. And actually spent the past 3 years working in interventional cardiology, totally unrelated to PT, but during that journey, missed becoming a physio, have so much in my brain, and just started sharing it and created an online practice just as a means of a hobby to keep myself mentally stimulated. And fast forward today, that has very much transpired into something much greater.
Yeah, no, it looks like Athletic Rebuild kind of exploded. I was going through your stuff and kind of not online stalking you, but just kind of doing research for this. And, you know, the social media presence looks good, the website, and then I saw your press release that you were able to raise, a seed round to try to get this thing a little bit more elevated.
Yeah. None of this was part of the plan, but here we are. I mean, Instagram, 2 years ago was a thing for family and friends to watch my American journey. And now it's a place where I teach the world how to blend rehab and performance, and loving that shift as unplanned as it was.
Well, there's always been a stumbling point with most PTs, and I think the Australian method's pretty interesting because I've worked with, as a former NFL player, injuries are just a natural byproduct of doing that job. And so I've worked with a lot of, kind of PTs and physios and out there, and I always felt that there was like a massive cavern, like a divide between like ice and stem and what the guys are doing in the rehab and like in the training room, and then like the return to play and the strength coach. And very few times like there was like a good meddling in the middle where like, those individuals came in and could understand dysfunction and seeing issues within not only like movement patterns and then more importantly how to fix it. And that was a massive kind of disconnect for me where I was like, hey, you guys can like technically do this side of it. And then you send us over to hear a bunch of strength coaches that don't understand exactly what you're doing. And so there's such a need for that return to play and helping people kind of reclaim themselves. Because as an athlete, like you get hurt and let's say you have surgery or something major, but then being able to kind of get back to where you were and to kind of find yourself again is extremely difficult. And a lot of people stumble and fall and don't do a very good job of making it happen.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. There is such a disjoint between the two worlds. And I think, you know, you step into the physio, physical therapy, rehab world, and it's still very much associated with manual therapy. People go there to be quote unquote fixed by needling, by cupping, by massage. It's all an illusion. This is all just temporary fixes. It's like throwing a Band-Aid on something that'll never heal. It's not actually finding the root cause. And I'm a big believer in that. And we all know our environment shapes the way in which we move. And the way in which we move then leads to sometimes overload. Overload then presents as pain. Now, our environment isn't the needling, isn't the cupping. It's actually the training that we're doing every single day. So why are we not impacting that and that being our first starting point?
Because so you can't bill insurance for it.
Yeah. Don't get me started on that.
Well, I mean, like it's true. Like I go see, like a chiropractor because I do jits and still train a bunch. And so just getting a little regular chiropractic little adjustment, like, you know, twice a month makes a lot of sense for me. But they want to kind of get you into this little bit of a model where it's like, oh, let's try this machine and this and this and this. And like whether or not they move the needle any amount, I'm not necessarily sure. But if you feel all right temporarily and it relaxes your nervous system and, you know, let's say it gets you out of pain for a minute and then you go and you leave and come back and the same stuff happens because people get right back into their same shitty movement patterns and lifestyle patterns and, shitty shoes and this. And I mean, you go back to your normal life and this is just what happens. But there isn't necessarily a model for people. I think with athletes, they understand it because they have performance as a metric for whether or not they're, doing the right thing. Whereas I think the average person just kind of bases their life like, am I in pain? Am I not in pain? And it's such a arbitrary kind of measuring stick for whether or not you're getting better or worse, or even if they understand that aspect of it.
Right. No, I completely agree. And I think, too, it's this endless cycle of you're doing your training, you're with a personal trainer, or you're doing whatever that may look like. And most of the time, it's shitty. I review programs very, very frequently, and they suck.
Yeah.
They are just overloading patterns in the same way over and over and over. And the reason they're in pain is so clear to me just by reading somebody's program.
Yeah.
So they continue to do this, and then they leave because they're in pain, and then they go to their physio. Physio then does the manual therapy, the hands-on, the real light-loaded stuff that truthfully doesn't translate to what they're doing, because most of the time athletes will go there, they'll do some banded stuff, they'll do some glute bridges, but then they'll go lift 300 pounds the next day. So where's that translation? How do we embed that into their training for it to actually create impact? So then we just get stuck in this loop of bad training, symptom management, no one actually gets out. Whereas if we were to just address the way in which people were moving from the get-go, train coaches to address people's movement patterns in a way that keeps them out of pain rather than just puts them in pain, we kind of avoid the circle altogether. So I think there's this big need for rehab coaches, clinicians to start stepping into this strength and conditioning world and strength and conditioning to start stepping into this rehab world to fix that gap.
So what do you use as your diagnostic in your model? Like an athlete comes in, like how do you assess them? Like what road do you take them on to, understand what their movement patterns are, what they're doing good and bad? And more importantly, like what does that journey look like?
Yeah, so I actually remove the word diagnosis entirely because I'm a big believer in diagnosis means absolutely nothing to me. It all comes down to how can you move, what works, what doesn't, and let's take it from there. So actually I've stepped away from my license and I now work under what I'd call a rehab coaching scope. And my approach is very much a zoomed out approach because ultimately there are so many factors to pain that if we don't address the low hanging fruits, I can be localized, I can identify poor upward rotation of the scapula as a result of your shoulder pain. But if you're sleeping 3 hours a night, no exercise is going to help you. So I very much zoom out initially, and step one with all of my clients and athletes is just going through a very in-depth conversation, something to which I would spend 45 to 60 minutes just speaking, which you could never do in clinic because ultimately you have to do 1,001 things in that time. And that conversation is very much focused on, okay, what is your pain presentation? What is it? How is it limiting you? When did it first start? Very typical that you would in clinic with a subjective history, but then going beyond that and saying, okay, talk me through your training. What does training look like? How has it changed? What is the volume? What is the style? From there, okay, talk me through stress, work, diet, sleep. How do these look amongst your daily life? Are we recovering? Are we drinking enough? What does the big picture look like?
We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Are you a field or court sport athlete looking to dominate the leaderboard? Let me introduce you to Field Strong. Take your inner athlete to the next level by exposing yourself to the advanced training techniques that contributed to my 10 years in the NFL. Unlock pinnacle performance and level up your athletic potential today. Head to powerathletehq.com/Field Strong and claim your 7-day free trial. Now back to the show. What I find interesting, and especially like as we're going a little bit farther, you keep coming back to pain as like a major driver for this. And that is extremely weird for me because pain was never a limiting factor. And like, I never went to the physio or the doc or anything because I was in pain. Like we had to postpone because I had to go have a doctor look at my knee. Like I was struggling a little bit with range of motion and for jujitsu. And so I went to the doc and I was like, man, I can't get my heel to my butt anymore. I'm losing extension. It's affecting my calf. So he x-rays my knee and he's like, you have more osteophytes and bony changes in your knee than I've ever seen. And he's like, you don't have any pain? And I'm like, no, I don't really have any pain. I just want more function so I can train better and be more lethal. And he's like, I'll clean it out for you. And I'm like, yeah, just clean it out and let me go on my own. So what's fascinating for me, and I maybe this is how I'm wired, but like pain has never been a limiting factor. So it's fascinating when I encounter people where it's like pain and their desire to get out of pain is their number one singular goal. And it like drives everything they do in this world. And I kind of tell people, if you can like that feels like such a broken model to me where like pain is the only divider or is the only kind of like, you know, like the only North Star you have.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, with pain can be an all encompassing thing, and people don't come to me because they're in pain. They come to me because the pain is limiting them from doing the things that they love. Hmm. So, you know, it's not a matter of, oh, I'm in pain, I really want to be out of pain. It's, I've been an athlete my whole life and I can't even put a barbell on my back anymore. And this is mentally affecting me more than I can explain. And I think that's the driver of people seeking. But yeah, look, I think to your point, there's so much that beyond pain that people should be seeking help for prior to this even establishing itself.
So what it sounds like is, and you mentioned low-hanging fruit. What you're saying is that for the majority of people, the reason that their performance is lacking and some of their pain is just associated with lifestyle. Lack of sleep, shitty diet, working too much, doing all these things. I mean, I feel like now you're almost in like a psychology role where you're trying to help people be better versions of themselves and helping them train better.
Yeah, truly. It's all a result of lifestyle factors. Pain is a result of overload, irrespective of what that may be. If it's not trauma, it is overload. So what is causing the overload? Of course, biomechanics is a factor to that, but sleep, stress, diet, training, shitty training is a massive, massive factor. And I think once we address these low-hanging fruits, we see this rapid and sudden change. And this is change in people that have seen surgeons, seen doctors, seen the PT, the chiro, and nothing works, quote unquote. But then suddenly they do all this, what to me is very basic and simple, and change then happens. And a big part of my philosophy and approach is because I do typically attract the people that they get on their first call and cry with me. I have grown men get on a call and cry because they are the man of the household that can no longer pick up their kid because their back will blow out. And step number one is, to your point, it's psychology. And I don't need to identify very specific deficits. I need to identify, how do I make them feel safe again? How do I make them feel confident in their body? Because right now they go to the gym and they're anxious because they don't know what they can and can't do. How can I give them a session that they can move? So one, give them endorphins. Two, allow them to finish and go, oh, holy shit, I didn't actually think about my back that session. Once we unlock that, then I can be a physio. But I'm a psychologist first.
Sure.
And I think that's a big thing that is not utilized well in this realm.
And by this realm, you mean here in the United States or just globally?
Globally.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, I would say it's, people are too tunnel vision and zoomed in. If someone comes to you with back pain, oh, well, let's treat your back. We've got to strengthen your back. Let's go do your back. Let's ask some more questions. Get a better picture first, because you're not really helping them doing that.
So give me some examples of shitty training.
Too much sagittal plane movement, push, 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 pull, 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 up, down, forward, back.
So just, I'm sure you're used just to it. Yeah.
The classic bodybuilder style.
Just nothing but like, I call it bilateral hip hinging in a sagittal plane. Like everything, yeah. I look like is some form of bilateral hip hinging. And
all bilateral, all sagittal.
Yeah, all the time.
That's quite literally in every single program that I see. Like, and I think what I find a lot of enjoyment out of is getting these really big, strong guys that can lift a shit ton of weight. And then I say, okay, do a quarter squat to a bench for me. Can't do it. Give me a Copenhagen plank. Can't do it. Give me a side plank hip abduction. Can't do it. I'm like, that's interesting. And you wonder why you're in pain. Yeah. Your body can't handle anything outside of the way in which you train it, but daily life demands that. Yeah. So that's why you got your back blew out when you reached for a ham on Christmas Day, because you're not exposing yourself to the demands of daily life. You're just learning yourself to look big and look strong.
Yeah. Now, one of the fascinating things for me, especially doing jits, is if I roll with dudes that are over the age of 40, they really struggle in anything that's transverse plane. So they have such shitty rotation within their trunk. And then they also lack abduction. So especially like abduction. So like as you roll with individuals, like the ability to kind of put a hand here and kind of like, you know, staple their leg to the ground and kind of like, I call it like split it like a wishbone. But like putting people in those awkward positions and like seeing the rotation, you'll see like almost people get this fear in their look. And it's because they don't train rotation. There's no transverse plane anywhere in their training. And they have such shitty range of motion in their hip that they just end up kind of getting stuck in these positions. And like it ends up causing fear. So it's pretty interesting, especially for guys that are trying to be competitive in a sport that requires it, that they just don't really do anything that mimics the training. Like, hey, like if this is something I'm struggling with and I keep getting in this position, like I'm going to need to start addressing this away from the mat. And I just don't know if a lot of individuals understand that piece or can really kind of take a step back and say, all right, here's the different planes of motions, the axes of rotation. These are things that I'm running into and this is causing me problems. I should probably address this somewhere other than this, this specific like individual kind of moment.
Absolutely. And I think the transverse plane beyond jiu-jitsu is something that we need in daily life as well. And it's, I would say, one of the fundamental things that I expose every athlete to, irrespective of what their sport is. And it makes massive difference. Because we've grown up in a world, too, where we went through this like core stability era, where we have to have a neutral spine, we have to have a stable core. Everyone's just bracing 24/7 and nobody knows how to move their spine now. Yeah. And then the minute we expose their spine to some rotation, everything lets go. And then they suddenly find this range and access to things they haven't been able to access. Because I think for so long, everyone's just said, squeeze your core, don't bend your spine, move from your hips. And this has now brought this secondary problem where nobody knows how to move now.
Yeah. Well, I personally laughed because I hate the word core. Apples and pears have cores, and I never want to be related to an apple or pear. But yeah, I mean, like there's this constant idea of like bracing and keeping your trunk. But if you watch, like the spine should bend. You know, you watch somebody go down and pick up, like, let's say a sandbag or something heavy. I mean, it's very hard to lift something awkward with a flat back. And unfortunately, like a lot of the movements that individuals are kind of doing over and over again in the gym, we don't see anywhere else within nature. So, I mean, all of a sudden now they do this movement, they go out and they pick up their kid with a round back, and then they wonder why they're in shearing pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's lack of exposure. Lack of exposure. It's not that riding your back is bad. It's the fact that you don't do it and you just suddenly did it. That's the problem.
So you work with athletes of all different levels, I assume, like kind of like, you know, from like, you know, the everyday warrior up to, you know, probably more professional athletes. How does that kind of like that mindset help you kind of like frame performance for those individuals? Because I know when you deal with high level athletes, it's very easy to discuss performance and they have like a metrics for this. Like, did I get better? Did I get worse? Is the training helping me kind of accomplish my task? What about for like the average individual? Is it just pain, but is there different other kind of, I guess you could say yard marks or, you know, different kind of landmarks that you shoot for those individuals?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's data-driven metrics to which I run assessments and I identify specific ailments within their body that are very much significantly impacted, to which we then reassess. And that data is obviously driving progression. But beyond that, I find that there's this common theme of, you know, the everyday athlete comes to me and says, I recognize I've been training like shit. Pain is obviously a factor to why I'm coming to you. But the one thing that I now want to seek is just longevity and resiliency. I want to be the grandparent that can run around with my grandkids. I want to be the husband that can continue to uphold the household when I'm old. And I think it shifts from data-driven metrics to rather, do I feel strong, fit, and healthy in daily life? Because right now I don't. And I think it's recognizing that in just small lifestyle things that then drives them to continue pushing. Because they go, oh, holy shit, I actually ran with the kids today and my back didn't blow out. I went through football and didn't even think about my hips. And I think that beyond data is probably the most meaningful thing for a lot of these people.
So how are you interacting with these individuals? Is it in person or is it remote or through Zoom? I mean, always?
Yeah, so I do everything remotely, entirely virtual now, and predominantly async as well. So people jump on a call with me initially, we'll go through an in-depth discussion, but beyond that, very much async approach to which, you know, I'll deploy testing, they perform in their own time, send back to me. I analyze in my own time, I create a plan, they then perform that plan in their own time. And I think the biggest thing here is ongoing dialogue. That's the most important thing in anyone's journey. And back to the traditional model of care, the downfall there is a lot of people don't need a physio for 1 hour. They need them when they need them. That being, oh, the random Wednesday morning when they woke up, it didn't feel good. Or the Thursday afternoon when you did jiu-jitsu and your back felt a little bit funky and you want to know if it's okay to train tomorrow. So having a model where I give them access to me whenever they need me, I think is one, that exponentially improves their trajectory of recovery, but two, actually just allows them to utilize me when they need me rather than just wasting time on an hour when it wasn't really necessary.
Are there any other levers you pull? Like, do you send people to see chiropractic, manual resistance? I know like a lot of the Australian PT method was a lot of PNF stretching and a lot of that kind of manual therapies. Do you utilize that as well?
Really, I'm a big believer in we have the tools in our own body to achieve all of these outcomes that external modalities can provide. Because ultimately, all of these modalities, massage, needling, they're all just external stimulus to give us an outcome. We can provide that external stimulus ourselves through foam rolling, through loaded mobility. Now, there are cases where I may recommend somebody going and getting massage, but that's typically, again, a neurological thing that I'm looking for there. I am wanting to desensitize their body to create a window of opportunity to then load. But it's not necessarily a matter of, oh, I think you need this because it'll fix you. It's more, you're in such a heightened state right now. And I think you yourself doesn't have the power right now to bring it down as low as we need it. So let's let somebody else get their hands on you just to bring that down so we can actually achieve the outcomes that we want with our training.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
I did, as I was scoping through your stuff, you said that training should be for life, not for punishment. So I thought that was a like pretty slick thing to do, because I think people do look at like training and like physical stuff as, and I do this with my kids. Like it's either like five squats or like five push-ups if they, you know, whatever it is, if they fuck around or like I tend to use some like physical stuff, being like, oh, you owe me five push-ups, dude. You didn't do that right. So how do you reframe training for somebody who's kind of in that mindset of like, you know, like this is training, this is health, this is making me better, more so than just some form of punishment, and maybe just changing the perception of how they're viewing training and more importantly, the outcome?
Truthfully, I would say I am not often fronted with that situation, because most of the people that come to me live and breathe training, and it's not punishment for them. I find it very rare that I am approached by somebody who knows it's good for them, so they should do it, but they don't really love it. It's not really the world that I'm in. I'm surrounded by people who live and breathe it. And what might look like punishment to one population is very much enjoyment for us. And that other population is one that I find myself not very much exposed to, truthfully.
And probably not interested in.
Yeah, true. And they're probably not interested in what I do either.
You know, the market we work with is a lot of ex-athletes. And I really enjoy working with those individuals. When I come across people that have never, you know, age 40 and they've never lifted weights and they never trained, I'm always like, really? Holy shit. Like where you been? You know, or you hear people all the time, I'm in the best shape of my life at 40 years old. And I'm like, what did your 20s look like? And I don't mean that like in a disrespectful way, but I just look at it like, man, like we've been lifting weight. I started lifting weights when I was like 14 years old, and it's been pretty much my full-time job since I was, you know, started getting scholarship offers when I was 16. And the fact that like people find this stuff so late in life is just, it's fascinating to me, because I'm like, what were you doing these last bunch of years? And so like for individuals that you're kind of finding, especially if they're coming to training late in life, is there a different way that you kind of approach that opposed from people that have, you know, been training like yourself, been training for, you know, since they were young kids?
Truthfully, I think irrespective of somebody's starting point, I have a very similar approach to which I start everybody at, because I find that even when I have these very advanced athletes, the foundations are so broken. Like I said, I can have an athlete that moves a ridiculous amount of weight on their back, but the minute I get them to do a very basic stability task, they lose it. So my approach, regardless of whether they're athlete or not, is just rebuilding foundations at a very basic level. Can we stabilize our joints? Do we know how to move our body as one? And once we establish that, then we kind of move things and escalate things in a way that suits their baseline. But I think starting at that foundation, irrespective of their starting point, one, opens people's eyes to, oh, damn, I've been doing this for so long and I cannot do this. Or I've never done this before and I'm starting to feel how good this feels. And it's not a matter of me telling them to convince them. It's them experiencing the change that just movement gives to them and their body that then, I think, allows them to shift their perspective on movement as a whole.
Interesting. So you obviously wear multiple hats. I mean, you're a coach, a physio, business owner. How do you like manage kind of like your own performance and your own training in the midst of all this stuff?
Great question. I mean, that's a number one priority for me above anything and everything. I think that's the one thing that I will not let suffer. I was actually having a conversation with someone recently and they said, maybe this is the season where you really need to just let go of training. And I said, absolutely fucking not. No way. Something else can go. That's not. But what I would say right now, like I am in a season of chaos. I am doing a lot. And what may seem like me training a lot to somebody else, I feel that I'm not training much. Right now I'm doing what is the bare minimum. I'm training Monday through to Saturday, 60-minute session. That's not much for what I've done for the past 10 years. So that's my way of managing it. Will I forego it entirely? Hell no.
So what do you have any training outcomes or any goals or anything that you're working towards?
I mean, we're in this world of running's the big trend at the moment, and I have never enjoyed running, but now I have been very much exposed to my poor ability to run in the way that I used to. So I now have this mental desire to be a very fast runner again. I initially went into this running journey of, okay, I want to go run a half and a marathon. And then I thought, I'm only doing that because everyone else is doing it. What I would actually really love for myself is to be fast again. And I think HYROX is obviously the way of the young world at the moment, but I foresee HYROX being an outcome, not just to do HYROX, but to be able to run fast kilometers. So I think, yeah, speed is probably my current outcome that I'm working on the back end of a knee injury right now. So that's the realm I'm stepping into or plan to.
Yeah, I feel like it was the rise of the hybrid athlete, like where now everybody, you know, and probably like the evolution of like, you know, with CrossFit and like with HYROX where people kind of want to blend a little bit. I like to run fast. I don't really care how long I run. Like that's like a major deal for me. And I know for my own knee injury, that was something where like I couldn't run on flat surface anymore. So where I live, I graded a hill in the back and we do hill sprints. And my theory is nobody runs poorly uphill. So
yeah.
I just have yet to see it. And so like
you actually have to learn to use your posterior chain rather than just slamming your body into the ground.
Well, that and you have to get like forward lean. Like you have to get like your chest over your knees and you actually have to get in a position and drive. And so I can do that pretty well. It just came to the point with my knee where I just was missing full extension, and that makes it extremely difficult to sprint and also in the deceleration. So I like when I found myself like, you know, like I think what happens with injuries is you end up adjusting your training and like you don't stop training. You just kind of pivot in new and interesting ways. And I knew when all of a sudden I couldn't effectively run the way I wanted to on flat ground, I was like, shit, man, this is something I got to fix. So, but yeah, I do have seen like the rise of like what I call the hybrid athlete, where now people want to be able to run long distance at a faster pace. Feels like a lot of run clubs here too in Austin.
Oh my gosh. Austin is a world of running. I mean, it's the reason I ended up in a knee injury is because I haven't ran for quite some time. And then I moved to Austin and everybody is running sub 3 hour marathons. And Classic Taylor's like, yeah, I can train with them. So I go straight into training with them. No, you cannot do that, Taylor. And I get clear example of overload right then and there. It wasn't the running. It was the fact that I decided to run with sub 3 marathon runners and train with them when I had no exposure to that before. But I think, yeah, everybody around me is fast and they're running long distances and I feel like a peasant around them. So I need to change that.
Well, so the one thing we've seen with, like, especially as you know, with running is managing load. And the problem is you just can't go out and run 100 miles a week the first week. And I think, like, you probably got yourself in trouble. Be like, I can fucking do this. Let's go.
Yeah.
And next thing you know. So what did you do to your knee?
I would say it's probably ITB, maybe a bit of a meniscus problem, but simply just overload. I did too much too soon. And I have a stronger side. My right is far stronger than my left. And left just couldn't keep up. And I think too, I just started running sprints around tracks and only ever ran with my left knee on the inside. Mm. And I think just that volume and that increase in pressure just led to a point of the knee going, I'm done. And now it's a very humbling experience because just like I do with my clients, I really got to strip it back and go back to the basics. Where am I lacking? What is not doing its job well? And that's kind of the process I've been at. And I mean, yesterday was the first day I got back to sprinting pain-free, which was a fantastic feeling. But it's sometimes nice to be your own client and experience what you're putting other people through.
So how long would the process take? I mean, I'm sure this is individualized, but like to be able to kind of rebuild somebody and help them take, is that like a 30 day, 60, 90 day? I mean, or is it just kind of like, you know, everybody's individual, but like, is there kind of like a landmark that you shoot for in trying to rebuild people and get them back into a situation?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely variability pending person. There's no one set answer. But what I will say is that we have a mindset right now where people think these are quick fixes and they're not. I say minimum 3 to 4 months, irrespective of your starting point. Anyone comes to me in chronic pain, I say you have to be patient for 6 months. And that doesn't mean 6 months and we're pain free. It means 6 months and we're starting to see outcomes. Now, that's not to say that I have some people that we start and a week in, they've been pain, like full of experiencing pain for 10 years and then a week in, they're entirely pain-free. And it just goes to show the impact of their lifestyle and how much it just needed change. But I would say very generically speaking, give yourself 3 months to see change.
3 months. Okay. So obviously you grew up in Australia and the one thing I know about Australians is they love to travel. So what are some of the fun places that you've traveled and seen outside the United States?
Great question. Yeah, us Aussies, we are not afraid of a long plane. I have been to Bali quite frequently. Bali, Thailand, Vietnam was actually an incredible trip. A lot of Europe. And then America. Yeah. I think they're the main places. And New Zealand.
Yeah, New Zealand.
That part of Australia, yeah.
New Zealand's beautiful. Oh, yeah. I taught a number of seminars in New Zealand, and every time we went there, like, I felt like I was, I mean, literally Lord of the Rings, because that's where they filmed it.
Yeah.
And then we got to go to, like, Hobbit Town and drive all around, and then went from, like, North Island down to South. And I read a book called, I think it was called Kiwi Tracks, where these guys had basically bought some, like, shitty van and basically drove all around New Zealand, you know, and, like, you know, stopped on the beach and dug mussels and just, like, had, like, a pretty amazing adventure. So I got a chance to do a little bit of that, but What's your favorite place thus far?
Oh, I would probably put Greece as my number one place of all countries I've traveled to. I think that was just a place where there was no comparison. I got there and it was a totally new experience. It's nothing like I'd ever been to before, and it was just beautiful. But I will say, classic Aussie, I love Bali. Do love me some time in Bali.
Why is that?
Oh, I think, one, we're made to be outside in the sun and by the beach, which is very much what Bali is. But I think, two, Bali just has this really cool culture that is growing right now of fit entrepreneurial people. Lots of expats moving to Bali just to run their businesses and train and surf. And I think it's a pretty damn cool life.
Is the, since all your stuff's online, like, why do you have to be in Austin? Is there any reason to hold you here?
No, there isn't actually. But what I will say is you know, I'm in a season of life right now where career is first, and the opportunity in this country is far beyond anything I've ever experienced anywhere else. And two, I think the community and people here in Austin is also something I've never been around before. I've never come to a city and been inundated with so much selfless support. You know, it's very frequent you meet people and they offer support and instantly you're like, what's the motive here? What do they want from me? But here it truly is just people saying, how can I help you? And that's something I haven't experienced before. So I think having that support around me in the season that I'm in right now is my priority.
Nice. So you have your online stuff's pretty slick, especially like your Instagram as I was going through. Like what's your approach to like content creation? And like for people that are looking to create content and try to, you know, because you blew up relatively fast, like what did you do that you think was unique, or did you model it off anybody? I mean, at the end of the day, you take a fit girl who looks good, you put her in some short shorts and a bra top and you do a bunch of like cool moves. Like who's not going to want to watch that? So not to disintegrate or cast any shade on what you're doing, but like that's part of the content creation piece, and like the movement is pretty good and you have to be a good mover. So like how did that whole thing kind of come about, and what was the kind of the outcome, and were you coached into it, or was it just something you naturally fell into?
Yeah, well, first thing I'll say is I never want to be that girl that's known for what she's wearing and how she looks. I hope that's not the first thought.
I wouldn't have reached out to you if you were a bimbo. I mean, I thought the content was great, and like the information was good, and I really liked the idea of like a return to play in that bridge, because I've washed my hands of conventional medicine. And, you know, especially with like doctors and painkillers and like all these just kind of masking, where it just looks like people get stuck in these patterns and they just go and they mask them and they get into them and nobody ever addresses it. And it's just better living through pharmacology and how much we can bill insurance, and like nobody really makes a meaningful change. And, like being able to discuss things like, hey, man, like you'd probably feel a lot better if you lost 20 pounds. You'd probably sleep a lot better if you built an aerobic base, and being able to kind of convey that. But there's so much fucking nonsense on social media. Like, I feel like I'm like shot in the face with a fire hose of utter fucking horseshit. And hold on, I'm going to pull it up. There was a pretty cool part. Oh, hold on. I shouldn't have. Damn it. I'm going to pull this up real quick. But somebody sent me an article from the New Yorker, and it's the idea that since the Industrial Revolution, humanity has gotten smarter about 3 IQ points a decade until about 2008. And they did a pretty massive study on this. And this guy went back, or this doctor went back and looked at the results. And hold on, let me pull it up. Where did I have? It is, it's called the Flynn effect. And after 2008, they went back and they started looking at IQ scores, and we're actually getting dumber at a much faster rate. And the reason, what they theorized was that we've given life and we've given platforms to really dumb people. And we've actually rewarded them for being idiots. And the people that are the biggest idiots tend to be the loudest. And those individuals that were pretty dumb just got kind of, you know, like stuck in the back into bars and like backroom places and nobody heard them. But now through the rise of like, you know, TikTok and social media, we've given rise to people that just put out shitty content, but they do it in such a volume that they just kind of drowned out the good stuff. So I think what I was getting back to for your content is like, how do you blend being able to kind of like make it flashy enough to where people want to come see it, but also provide them enough information that you can continue to drive the needle forward?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It's a world that is flooded with misinformation. And I think I didn't step into this with training or knowing what I was doing or trying to mimic anybody. Truthfully, the first post that started to blow up my presence was back to the point we discussed initially. I spoke about how we've lived in an era where everybody has been trained to not move their spine and we need to rotate. And it was very much just my own brain put into thoughts in a video of me doing movements, but also explaining the whys behind. And it just took off. And I then recognized, oh, if I actually share my own thoughts, I watch everybody just copy everybody. They're all just copying the next trend, the next cool thing. But then I started to think, you know what? I'm not going to do that. I'm genuinely just going to put out what I think, even if I think it's quite unconventional and may not be received well. And every single thought of mine that was quote unquote unconventional took off. You know, then I started to speak to, okay, well, why do we only load our hip flexors eccentrically as we're going down into a lunge and squat? Nobody is ever loading open chain hip flexion. Why do you think we have tight hips? They're so weak. Bam, that took off. I'm like, okay, wow. People do want real thoughts here. And that was the driver initially of social media. It was very much just share your brain, Taylor, and don't try to copy other people. And then from there, I started to recognize the world of content. And then I realized we live in this world, again, back to the world of dumbness right now, is people don't have an attention span beyond 2 to 3 seconds.
Yeah.
So even if I have an incredible concept, if I don't present that well in those first few seconds, nobody wants to stay. So then I started to understand like the psychology of understanding attention, and it's very much capturing somebody in those first few seconds. But the big thing that I'll always stand by is I want everybody to have left every post of mine having learned something. You know, I don't want it to be, like you'd mentioned before, the classic girl that just puts on some nice booty shorts and looks good. I genuinely want you to come to my post and think of Taylor as the Taylor that I learned something from, not Taylor the girl with nice activewear or something.
Do you think the Australian accent helps?
Yeah, I started to realize that. Once I started doing voiceovers, everyone like, oh my God. I'm like, I'm going to use this to my advantage. I tell you what, it's something works. You've got to milk in this country because you can.
Well, yeah, it's like one of my favorite, like, so I'm originally from California. And so when we moved to Texas and like lived all over, you know, a Southern accent on a girl sounds great. On a dude, I think it just sounds ridiculous. I can't take dudes with Southern accents like seriously at all. You know, but you hear with a girl, like you can kind of hear it, you're like, oh, it sounds kind of cute. But then for dudes, I'm like, oh, this is painful. And so, you know, but the funny, when I remember when I first went to Australia, we taught a seminar, actually it was in Newcastle. And the interesting thing for me was how many like big, strong athletes there were in Australia. Like there were dudes who showed up that were like 6'4", like 240 pounds that were super fit and like looked the part to the point where I was like, shit. They always, you know, because in this country they always talk about, or actually they don't say this so much anymore, but there was this idea like what happened to the good white athletes? And like when I was like, no, they're all down in Australia. I found them. So they were, but yeah, yeah. We worked with a bunch of like rugby league, rugby union guys and a bunch of Aussie rules football dudes. And while I'm not a huge fan of Aussie rules football, the amount of fitness that those individuals have is like nothing I've ever seen. Like the amount of running and speed and just volume those guys could handle was like astronomical. When they started talking to me about their training, I was like, I think I'm gonna throw up just listening to this.
Yeah, no, truly. Even when I came to America, I mean, I what I thought was normal, that being quite literally everybody you know wakes up at 5 a.m., they train at 5:30, they do a hard session, they go to the beach, they go back to the gym in the afternoon. That was not normality for me. That wasn't abnormal to anybody around me. And then I came to America and I thought, why is nobody doing this? Why do I stand out like a sore thumb here when I definitely do not back home? And that was a very, very stark contrast. But to your point, to the football as well, I remember coming here and watching NFL and going, why do they stop so much? Nothing happened to be that.
Yeah, yeah. No, when I went down there, you know, the guys, they had a lot of like preconceived notions and like a lot of like kind of quips and whatnot about American football and this and, you know, versus footy and all the other stuff. And I just tried to explain it to them. I'm like, you know, basically you get armor and you get to get down and they basically hike the ball and you get to try to mash individuals with armor. And like there's an inherent safety associated when you're not wearing an 8-pound helmet that you're trying to ram into somebody. So it's just a different game, but I love like the rugby stuff. I wish I was exposed to that at a younger age. I would have loved to have played that at a high level. And, but you know, like in America, it was like either play basketball or football and, didn't get necessarily exposed to that till I went to college. So going forward, what's up in the future? I mean, you raised some seed money. You're looking to kind of expand. Like, what does 2026 look like for you?
I think my big overarching mission and all that I do is shaping the face of rehab to the point that we're speaking about initially. We have this disjointed world right now where there's rehab and then there's training. And I want to blend that both for the rehab clinicians and also for strength trainers as a means to get people out of this pain cycle. And also beyond pain, you know, train people in such a way so they don't even get to pain and need somebody. So that's my big mission that I'm very much pushing in all that I do currently. 2026 is very much focused on Rebuilder, which is the platform and ecosystem to which I will carry out that mission, both for clinicians and consumers. So yeah, very much head in the ground, working hard, and hoping I can see light at the end of the tunnel next year, maybe.
Are you like educating and teaching coaches? Like how, like are you going on the road? Are people coming in? Is it all virtual? Like how are you doing that?
Yeah. So three sets to the ecosystem: one, education; two, the actual tech; three, the consumer and driving demand to train clinicians. So on the education side, entirely virtual. Ultimately running people, one, through my philosophy, my method, and the way in which I train and coach people and assess. And then two, running them through the business, because people don't know how to work online. We have incredible, incredible clinicians that have an incredible skill set, but don't know how to use it beyond the traditional, someone sees me for 30 minutes and that's all that they get. So running them through everything that they need to know. And then the vision is ultimately building out this as an academy to bringing on incredible talent that can speak to very specific things. You know, I have some incredible friends in the PT space right now that are going to come in and do some clinical training by mechanics so that we can speak to both the personal trainer and the clinician. And yeah, delivered entirely virtual. I would love, and this is on the cards, probably not next year, but the year following. Physical therapy conferences suck. They're boring. They're shit. So I would like to start the new one, a national physical therapy conference, bring all the top talent to speak to things that actually matter. And that's definitely something that I'll probably start planning next year to perhaps look out for the following. So definitely changing the face of rehab is the big mission here.
Is there any individuals that you're a big fan of?
Dr. Meg, if you look up Dr. Meg ZDPT on Instagram, she's a good friend of mine. I think she's a genius. Absolutely incredible in the way that her mind thinks and she approaches rehab and training performance. I mean, she's impressive. She moves beautiful and she moves well.
Just
an incredible
Dr. Meg.
Dr. Meg, yeah, MEGSI.DPT.
Okay, cool. Yeah, my one of my oldest friends, Kelly Starrett, wrote that book, The Supple Leopard. And when I got hurt my last year in the NFL, Kelly's who I rehabbed with. So he's kind of like my barometer for a lot of the PT stuff. But cool. So you want to try to get a bigger spotlight on her. Anybody else you kind of dig on? Like especially strength coaches?
Strength coaches.
No.
I mean, I have another friend, Dr. Susie Spurlock, who also rehab and strength and conditioning. Incredible. She blends those worlds together. And she's actually created a very incredible online practice, kind of preaching the message that I am here. She's fantastic as well. I mean, there's so much talent out there in this world. I think right now we just need to bring it all together and start actually driving this mission.
Awesome. Well, if people want to get a hold of you, it's Taylor Cannon on Instagram, and then Athlete Rebuilder will post the links. And dude, this was awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time, and hopefully we can put a little bit of a spotlight on you. And I do live here in Austin too, but I live out kind of outside of Austin. So maybe one day we'll get a chance to meet.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate this. So much fun. It was really lovely to meet you.
Yeah, pleasure. Okay. Well, thanks for tuning in. Another episode of Power Athlete Radio. See ya.
This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show. Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales we've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's klfi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.